You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome back to the show. I just got back from Florida for the Florida Surf Film Festival. Perhaps you heard about that over on The Grit, but it was awesome to connect with East Coast fans. Thank you all for coming out. It was also really rad to watch surf films in a theater. Great environment. It's kind of what surf film was designed for. The energy is palpable in a group of people and a group of like-minded people, no less, surf fanatics. Also, though, through interacting with people, I realized through a few conversations that not everyone is aware, somehow, not everyone is aware of the various shows that I'm producing. As I've kind of delineated things onto their own feeds, I think things get lost for people who aren't listening on a weekly basis. So this is your reminder that you can find everything. I'm producing a lot of shows. You can find them all on surfsplendorpodcast.com. The shows are Spit with Scott Bass for surf news, The Grit with Chaz Smith for surf gossip. Those are gross generalizations, but that is essentially the genre for each of those shows. And now surfboard shaper Donald Brink has his own show, Swell with My Soul. So those are the shows. Those are the titles you could search for in your iTunes app. But again, you could find them all on surfsplendorpodcast.com. And then if you enjoy this content and that content, you should know that it's all listener supported with an assist from sponsors like Spy and Neat Essentials. If you're interested in being a sponsor, feel free to reach out. But to support the listeners who contribute to this show, I am raffling off a surfboard this month, an Alaia. So everyone who's made a financial contribution to the show in the month of June will be entered to win. I'm going to select that winner on July 1st. Leon from Morningwood Surfboards on Oahu will shape a custom-built Alaia from Polonia wood for the winner. So the winner will only be responsible for the shipping cost of getting that board from Oahu to wherever they are located. And in previous episodes this month, Leon's been explaining a little bit about the history and the design characteristics of an Alaia. And just as a refresher, it's a finless wood plank with a round nose and a square tail, a hard edge along the rail, all the way around the rail. And then the flex dynamics are a key attribute to that board. The way that Leon builds them, that sharp edge around the rail serves as essentially a fin for the board to kind of hold on to the water. And then the flex allows you to catapult with a little bit of projection to get drive out of the board. So the lack of fins means that there's zero resistance, so the board absolutely flies. The speed is the biggest draw for these types of boards, and then learning to control it with that edge and allow it to release with the slide is where all of the work comes in.
It's the speed, it's the slide. You know, you can get way out on the, just haul ass out onto the corner and do like a kind of like a cutback, but it's like a slingshot into like a 360, so like a reverse 360 back into the bowl. First time I did it, I didn't stop turning. I didn't know how to do that, so I was like 720 back into the bowl. And then you realize, okay, at first you put your hand out and it stops your spin, but in some ways it's similar to snowboarding. It's the connection to the past. It's something, it's the challenge. So you kind of have to be hard-headed and stubborn to get on it and surf it consistently. I go to Mexico every year and you throw that in my longboard bag and it's 6-7 pounds. Doesn't really count as an extra board because people don't even know what it is. Like, ideally, I surf Alaya first. And if I was going to have a multi-session day on a surf trip, I surf Alaya first because you need every ounce of energy. You know, if you're surfed out, you're not going to hop on Alaya and start ripping. It's like you need every ounce of energy to catch those waves. And it also just, it teaches you a lot of how to tap into the wave and where the speed is and what the current's doing, what the reef is like. You're underwater, it duck dives like a rock. So it's just a different perspective on everything. I don't know, you have to change your expectations of how many waves you're going to catch out there. So every wave becomes more precious and it gives you a different perspective. I mean, I think overall every surf break would be benefit from everyone having to put some time in on that, because it kind of builds compassion towards everybody else, you know.
At Morningwood Surfboards on Instagram, thank you, Leon, for offering to build that board. SurfSplendorPodcast.com/donate is where you can donate to win that board and actually have it custom built for you to your specs. Thank you for your support. Today's episode is with Dr. Aaron James. Aaron is a PhD from Harvard University and is professor and chair of philosophy at UC Irvine. He's a lifelong surfer and the author of the book Assholes, A Theory, and just recently, another book, Surfing with Sartre, An Aquatic Inquiry into a Life of Meaning. This book offers a lot. One thing is that it gives a nice historical context for exactly how lucky we are, you and I are, to be born into this time in history, not simply because of the internet, podcasts, access to information, readily available food and water, but really kind of more in relation to what he talks about in this book is we're lucky to even have the luxury of leisure pursuits. So much of human history was centered simply around survival. So this conversation is completely unique from any that I've had on this show. Aaron talks not only about our good fortune, but the actual importance and value of centering one's life around the sublime and around the beautiful. He also talks about being burned by Andy Irons at Lowers. He talks about how climate change will affect all of our favorite surf spots. This conversation goes deep and wide, and I did my very best just to keep up with Aaron. So I hope that you enjoy. This is David Scales for Surf Splendor. Hope that you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Aaron James. I'll be back at the end to sign us off. Thanks. Takes his final breath. But first checks his news feed to see what he's about to miss. It occurs to him a little late in the game. We leave as clueless as we came. Rented heavens to the shadows in the cave. We'll all be wrong someday. Oh, I've never chatted with a professional philosopher about surfing before,
right?
Are there many of you? Are you one of a kind?
Yeah, not that many, actually. There's a few people in the profession who have some connection with it, who surf in various capacities. Actually, a little conference that's now been going on a couple years in a row now, that's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah. What is the conference?
Well, we just had it in Del Mar, the second one. The first year of it was in Tofino, Vancouver Island. And so it's like philosophers giving philosophy papers or talks related with some connection with surfing, and then otherwise hanging out and just going surfing together and stuff. And actually, our keynote this time was Bill Finnegan, who wrote Barbarian Days.
Yeah,
won the Pulitzer Prize for that. He was out, so that was fun. So we surfed, and he, you know, was involved and gave us a nice talk and stuff.
Yeah. Is he a philosopher?
No, he's not. You know, he was just curious to kind of dip in to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had him on the podcast when the book came out.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Interesting guy. Yeah. Can you tell me about our constitutional right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as it relates to surfing?
Yeah.
Let's start
right,
there.
Right.
I've never heard this before.
Yeah, right. So life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, that's a saying in the Declaration of Independence, and it's a riff on the philosopher John Locke, who had a big influence on the American founders. But he wrote about natural rights to life, liberty, and property. So there's a question, why did they keep life and liberty but drop property and substitute the pursuit of happiness? And so one theory about this is that it originates from stories about surfing in the South Pacific, especially Tahiti, that came back from Captain Cook's vessel when they first discovered it. So when Captain Cook first went there, actually a couple times after, the crewmates had written stories about the locals surfing. And then finally on one trip, one of the local crew members tried it in a boat, like went out in a boat and surfed a wave. And another guy writing about it said, you know, I don't know if I have the line exactly, but it said, I couldn't help but conclude that this man felt the most supremest pleasure being driven along so fast and smoothly by the sea. And so there was, along with stories of surfing, there was of course stories of like sexual escapades with the local Tahitian women. So this paradise, right? That's beautiful. But those stories got back to both England and France. And at the time it brought up the idea, which was totally new in the under the sun for in the North anyway. And that was the idea that happiness was possible on Earth. And the idea was, well, maybe you could organize a society, and if happiness is possible on Earth in the South Pacific, how do we bring it to the Northern Hemisphere? And in fact, Napoleon, before he became, you know, Napoleon Bonaparte, we know, he wrote like an article about happiness, trying to become kind of a Rousseau type figure, Rousseau, who'd written about democracy for the first time in modern thought. One theory is that this thinking about happiness and from Tales from the South Pacific helped motivate the French Revolution, and to implement the Rousseau's social contract. And so it didn't go so well for a long time with the bloodbath that ensued. But that was the animating idea. And in fact, in the end, it worked out well. And that also inspired the American Revolution. They did draw from Rousseau and Locke's thought in the American Revolution and looked to France as an example of both how to do things and how not to do things. But one idea is that the preoccupation with happiness comes directly from those stories. And so it could be that the American founders in the culture, that really goes back to surfing in the first. So it's not just that surfing came to, which is true, came to, you know, came California and New Jersey, and like Duke Kamanamuku came and did some exhibitions. I think that was in the 30s or around there. So that was when it was sort of first introduced in modern times. But there's a deeper story potentially about how it inspired the sort of original concern for the pursuit of happiness in American life. Now, I don't know if we've, like, as a country, lived up to it that well.
Sure. It's a whole different conversation.
Yeah.
I wonder what that guy was riding. What type of board
yeah.
he was riding.
I think it was a boat, but I don't know what the locals...
Like a canoe or
something? Yeah, something like that. But I don't know what the locals were riding. It might have been... I'm not sure if it was a canoe or a stand-up type thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if that predates what's known to have happened in Peru or whatever, sure. or if it was connected. I don't know the history well enough there, but yeah.
Was happiness such a foreign concept?
Yeah, it absolutely was, right? I mean, people... It's a new thing under the sun, in the same way that valuing liberty is a creature of modern political thought. It was an innovation. In earlier times, pre-modern times, you know, people had their station and didn't worry about happiness. And certainly in medieval thought, but back in ancient Greece, there was more of a concern for happiness, but it meant something different. It meant sort of doing well as a person, being virtuous, being successful, but they didn't think that you sort of have a pursuit of your personal happiness through liberty. That's just distinctively modern thought. Yeah,
it's interesting. I guess maybe I touched on it when I was in college and I took one or two philosophy classes or something like that, but I hadn't thought about it really about the context that we live within until I read the book. And the book did kind of illuminate that for me and put it into context. Great. And was like, oh, the era of leisure pursuits and stuff like that is all new, and we should be hugely grateful
for
the time that we live in.
No, in fact, I think in the start of it, really, the leisure revolution, as I call it, within capitalism happened in the late 1930s with the introduction of the 40-hour work week. Right. It's something we take for granted. Or surfers, of course, think 40 hours, my God, you know, work, banking hours, that's like the peak surfing hours the whole week, you know. So like we grow up like trying to get around the 40-hour work week. But itself, it was a hugely important innovation, because the idea was at the time, you know, before employers would ask people to just work, you know, sleep a little and then work the rest of their time.
Yeah.
And then there were some traditions, you know, have the Sabbath, or you could protect, there was like one protected day in some places. But the idea, the argument was made, no, look, it should be 8 hours for sleep, 8 hours for work, and 8 hours for whatever else you want to do, right? Just even this leisure, not just for rest to be more productive, but to live, you know? Yeah. And so the 40-hour work week got going. And then in the post-war, after World War II, with the American economy had done really well after the war, it had this new big middle class, low income inequality. And then now this work week that was sort of, so people were wealthier than ever and had more, and now had a sort of protected free time.
Sure.
And that's what, that's when surfing like really got going, you know, the start of it as sort of a cultural force, right?
Sure.
People had time and they had the resources, you know, cars and surfboards to catch on and start innovating surfboard design. And the Bruce Brown films, you know, are partly celebrating, you know, with 1966, The Endless Summer, and also his On Any Sunday, you know, the motorcycle film, is celebrating that new leisure culture. But that's like unprecedented in the history of the world, right? And it's now something we really take for granted, but it's relatively new.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, we will get into the book and how surfing, you know, as a leisure activity or recreational activity relates to all of that. But before we do, the book kind of touches on something that I've always felt, and I've never really been able to articulate it, but I think about it all the time, and I probably won't be able to articulate it very well here either. And to put it cheesy, it's that surfing is kind of a metaphor for life, you know? And to put it less cheesy, it's like a lot of the lessons you learn in surfing basically instill kind of values, character, and principles that will serve you well through either work, family relationships, and just getting through life. The book kind of constantly touches on those things. And so I really enjoyed reading it for that reason. It was kind of like, oh, it illuminates all these things that I've kind of been aware of innately and haven't been able to articulate. And I don't really know that anybody's really fully articulated it well. I think the worst versions are it is when Hollywood has tried to make a movie about it. You know, it's yeah, just like, right, yeah. Oh, surfing's this great thing. And yeah. They never do it successfully. But I think the book did it successfully in a lot of ways.
That's great to hear. Yeah. I mean, for me, actually, I mean, growing up, you know, as a surfer, lifelong surfer, but then also now like a philosopher, professional philosopher studying a lot. You know, I always had a vague sense just of that, like that,
yeah.
That being a surfer really like helped in life. And like, and even like friends in philosophy would say like, oh, you're so lucky to have that, you know, like it, because it made a difference sort of to how I would work or, you know, but I was never very beyond sort of the Hollywood or the cliches kind of thing myself, you know, for a really long time. It was really when I sort of thought, no, I should really figure out what surfing and philosophy have to do with each other. And then I started thinking through the connections more explicitly sort of, and it was an odd thing because then in explaining, you know, trying to nail the essence of surfing and then thinking about other examples of it, you know, I sort of learned all of this stuff about myself and my life that I couldn't have never said before I really thought about it. So it wasn't just that I was learning about surfing. I felt like it was like, I was learning about my whole life story and things that like had clearly been really important to me my whole life that are important to surfers. That if somebody you'd asked me before, I just wouldn't have been able to say it. So it's a weird way that philosophy led to this kind of not just intellectual discovery, but self-understanding.
And was that prior to writing the book? And what was the impetus for the book specifically?
Yeah, well, I guess I'd written this other book, Assholes, a Theory, that did well. And then there was kind of what's next, you know, sort of thing. And then I thought, well, the thing I really want to do is that I figure out what surfing and philosophy have to do with each other. I had a sense that I didn't really know. I often made various connections,
yeah,
you know, but thinking though, really like work through in a serious way, you know, how the two relate to each other. So I thought that was just like a cool project and it'd be new. And then, you know, and now I could do it. Maybe if I just started writing that book that, you know, like a major commercial press, maybe they wouldn't have been interested, but on the heels of another successful book, you know, then they think, okay, yeah, this will fly, you know, kind of thing. So I got into it and then it was just through that gradual process of figuring things out, of piecing it together for myself that I, you know, for example, I realized that a lot of my life was organized around, not just skillful activity, but the sublime and the beautiful. Those are just like, since, you know, I was a kid, that's been sort of the, central preoccupation and like in a really devoted way, those couple things, and attunement, increasing attunement through skillful activity, not just like, you know, in getting good at a trick or a sport, but in a way that's inspired and motivated by the beauty of waves and the beauty of surfing and the sublimity of the ocean. And now I can say a lot of stuff philosophically about those concepts or even put those words on it. But beforehand, you know, I wouldn't have been able to really nail it down in those terms.
A part of me while reading it was thinking like, man, you're taking surfing way too seriously, you know, like, yeah, yeah. Like just have fun. It's all good. You don't have to figure out what the meaning is, you know, and then part of me also, I mean, you'd have to be, it sounds cliche to say things like, oh, surfers have all the answers. And like, what is the meaning? Mm-hmm. But, or to even assume that it's an enlightened path, I feel is also somewhat kind of, I don't know, arrogant almost, but you'd have to be ignorant to not acknowledge that something that you do on a daily basis definitely has implication for your worldview, certainly, and even how you treat other people, how other people interact with you, all of it. It does. So it's worth analyzing, you know?
Yeah, yeah, right.
And I do think that surfing, I don't know, you didn't, I mean, you kind of touched on it. You never said it explicitly, but like surfing is unique, you know? It's different than even other, in skateboarding or snowboarding or even things, that, the only thing that I've ever heard people talk about that even comes, that is even similar to the way people talk about surfing is rock climbing.
Right.
You know? But even that I don't feel is, that's a stagnant surface and you can kind of go there and do it repeatedly. So surfing is unique.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's certain ways of thinking about it that make it not so special and, you know, not really interesting to pursue. Like if you think it's just another source of pleasure, or surfing's just about having fun. I mean, there's a lot of ways to have fun. You can play Parcheesi, you can, you know, black, you know, pick up sticks, you know, you can have fun playing little games, whatever, for example. And now games are actually philosophically interesting in themselves, but not necessarily any particular, not Parcheesi per se, right? Like, you know, what's the meaning of life? Well, let's think really hard about Parcheesi. So that wouldn't fly. So, but is surfing like that or not? It's an open question. When people say, oh, surfing's fun, I think that's not really what we love about it exactly. Yes, it's very fun, but it's not just another way of having fun. It's not just another way of having enjoyment, or it's a really special kind of enjoyment. And then once you start thinking about why, like what the enjoyment is about, and then you start getting, well, it's not just the same thing as any ocean sport, or it's not even just right. You know, and you get to these differences, and that's, I sort of operated with, you know, the sort of pretext that, kind of a hubris, you might, as you were suggesting, that there is this distinctive meaning. But that was, to me, was like, you know, it was kind of a conjecture. Like, is this really a defensible position? And then I think it is in the end, right?
You know, like, I think so, too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. If you're a surfer already, you know, it's easy to be convinced. But can you really articulate it in a way so that other people, you know, who don't surf can think, oh, well, yeah. Maybe it's not the only good thing in life, but I can see how there's really something special about it. And I think people have a sense of that anyway. Just
I think they do.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this just really articulates it in a way that, you know, just watching Jeff Spicoli or whatever wouldn't, or even comments, you know, made by professional surfers or famous surfers, you know, which are useful. I mean, some people do sort of listen to Laird Hamilton, like the sage, let's see what the godlike man, you know, has to say, like, you know, and then, you know, he says maybe some fine things, but nothing that necessarily would, you know, make people feel like, oh, I totally get surfing now, you know. So, yeah, that makes sense, because I didn't know what that was either for a long time until I really worked at it. Yeah.
Getting into the book specifically, are we pronouncing it Sartre or Sartre?
Yeah, both are fine.
Sartre,
yeah.
Okay. Who is Jean-Paul Sartre?
Yeah, Sartre, he's the great, one of the great existentialists of the 20th century, both a literary figure who won the Nobel Prize in literature, but then also a philosopher, you know, from France. Let's see what else to say about him. You know, well, he was a sort of dark figure in the sense that he captured a lot of the anxieties, you know, of the time. He was a prisoner of war in World War II. He wrote part of his great masterwork, Being in Nothingness, while he was in a prison camp. And part of that book actually has these long discussions of snow skiing and how it exemplifies freedom. And it's a funny thought to think of him in a concentration camp banging out pages about skiing, you know, and freedom. So, but he was, you know, there's some aspects of his views, of his existentialism, have kind of some surfy aspects to it. But then his way of doing philosophy is definitely, well, phenomenology as it's called, is just sort of just look at what things are like and then try to just capture them and extract their philosophical meaning just from what it's like or like a good characterization of it. Without sort of operating with an abstract theory and then just applying it to the phenomena. And so then that works really well if you want to figure out surfing, you know, sort of following Sartre's lead. He in the way that he does a phenomenology of skiing, try to do surfing as well.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it or to reveal the book to listeners who haven't read it, but your claim is essentially that surfers are on the right side of history. Am I right?
Yes.
In that we're kind of in regard to kind of outlook, time management, handling finite resource, that sort of thing. That is the
Right. I mean, so I think that for a bunch of reasons, capitalism is likely to, well, it's both maybe necessary and probably desirable for us to work less, to have a shorter work week, and then, you know, for people who are very attached to the Protestant work ethic, that like is a stressful proposition, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, no, meaning is all I have. That's my sense of my identity, my sense of status and skill and in life. And, you know, yeah, sure, a little bit of rest, you know, but just to recharge the batteries for work or whatever. Surfers, on the other hand, are like, oh yeah, shorter work week, sure. You know, as long as the waves aren't going to get more crowded, you know, right. You know, kind of thing. So happy to work less and very much keyed in with the idea that, you know, money, getting rich, capitalism is supposed to make us rich. But it's not just to have money. It's not just to be wealthy. It's not just to have like ever bigger houses, ever nicer cars. It's to do other things like go surfing, be in beautiful places, spend time with family and friends, surfing great days at the beach. Like that's the whole meaning of life obtains in a good enough sense, like on those days, on the good waves. Right. That's the whole point of it. Right. So the idea of capitalism, right, is poverty is terrible and you don't do a lot of surfing, you know, if you're poor. And, you know, I go to Nias for a month every year and then some of the surfers paddle out like on really yellowed boards and they're like guys who work in the rice fields, you know, to get enough rice just for they get paid in rice, work all day, and they might squeak out for the evening session. But like, that's not, you know, they're poor. They're not rich enough to surf regularly, even though they're right in front of like a beautiful wave. So there's nothing great about that. So capitalism is a great thing because it has this magical capacity to raise our standards of living, to eliminate poverty. So in that sense, surfers should welcome it, right? You know, it's what creates the possibility of meaningful leisure of working less.
Yeah.
The efficiencies increasing. But then there's another view about capitalism, which acts as though, you know, it's just getting richer for its own sake is the point, right? Just having ever more, you know, a kind of race. And that's kind of insane. Although our culture loses track of that idea. It loses track of the idea that there's actually even as economists call it, an opportunity cost or something you give up by working more. Right. Unless it's time with the family, they'll say, oh, yeah, we're that, you know, yeah, sure, maybe you could take some time off work to be with the family. But other than that, you know, the idea is that, you know, you're supposed to sort of get as rich as possible or get as much status as you can in whatever achievements, you know, within your profession or, you know. So the sort of cultural values are always oriented around sort of having ever more and not the intrinsic meaning that comes with the things that you do with free time. So. Surfers and some already get that there's something really wrong with the whole, you know, from go, you're trying to figure out how to sort of work around, you know, how to have enough money to be basically to be able to surf a lot and be flexible schedule so you can on it when the waves are good, travel a little bit. So you're already kind of outside of the conventional expectations. Now, like that might have been seen as a kind of a hippie attitude or, you know, at a certain, you know, period. I think it's sort of for various reasons, it's inevitably, or at least, and it would be a good thing to have it be the future of capitalism. I mean, for one thing, as automation, artificial intelligence, especially deep learning, which is really incredible, does more and more to automate jobs, there's a real chance that it can start to outpace that destroys jobs for people. People are often retrained for new work, the opportunities for work are created, but there's a real risk that the pace of automation goes faster than people can be retrained in new things. So in that case, there may not be as many opportunities for work, in which case we can think we can fight that, right? Or we can think, no, okay, let's just work less and then let's standardize it, you know, have a shorter work week, professionalize part-time work, pay a basic income, which might be necessary anyway. And surfers are sort of already on board with doing this. Oh yeah, twist my arm. Okay, yeah, sure. Fine. So they're on the vanguard of this, of a new, more leisurely kind of capitalism. And then also for climate change reasons, which is, you know, of special importance to surfers, given that rising sea levels threaten to destroy the world's surf spots, you know, relatively, well, not right away, but, you know, in the, over a century or so, but, you know, might not be too long before low tide spots are gone. Desert Point is gone, for example. You know, well, the work that we do, work is one of the big sources of our emissions.
Sure.
And so, and one thing we can do to reduce our overall emissions is just work less. After the 2008 financial crisis, when unemployment was high, emissions dropped a lot and then came back as people were working more. So now unemployment is a bad thing, is a shock, right? But if you can do a more orderly kind of reduction of work, professionalize part-time work, reduce the work week, pay basic income, things like that, and have a culture that puts more value on things like surfing or spending time with family or kids, you know, or friends at the beach and or the lake, or, you know, games and other sports, you know, that's already in the culture to some degree. But if it could be really have a culture more oriented around that as a source of meaning in life, you know, then there's a sort of much smoother transition through a lot of big sort of world historical changes, developments in technology, climate change, that are like just coming down the pike that we're not even half prepared for at the moment, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, the surfer shows the way, I think, to a kind of more graceful transition through those kinds of problems.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
There's a lot in there that I want to unpack.
Cool.
That I've got in my notes. But back to the beginning, one of the things you were saying, like, I identify as a surfer, have for pretty much since I was 12 probably, and I actively surf pretty much that whole time. Even I forget some of the things that you've said, and I get caught up in that capitalist thing that you're talking about, where it's just about gaining, you know, and acquiring. And it's hard, man. I mean, when you say it, it makes perfect sense in theory. It's hard in practice.
Yeah.
It's hard to abandon your capitalist pursuits in practice and just reset on a daily basis.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, there's
on the coast it is anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, but it's an interesting question of why we work as much as we do. I mean, for a lot of people, like, who haven't had a pay raise for a long time, you know, because wages have been stagnant for lower skilled workers for a long time, you know, they're working longer just to have, you know, a new car or whatever, or pay the bills,
yeah.
You know, so you can understand there. But for a lot of people, they're just working harder, you know, the idea to get a little bit richer. You know, we're spending more and more time on average working just to eke out, have a little bit and taking on more debt to have nicer stuff. So, I mean, what's behind that? It's actually a kind of important question, interesting question. But one answer is that it goes to a deep part of our need for status. So there's kind of our sense of like whether we measure up, you know, might be how we think we compare with the Joneses, whether we're doing better than or we're kicking ass relative to the average or we're behind. And that sort of status is what we might think we get from making more money or having signs of wealth. And then, you know, and that's a kind of an evolving standard because, you know, if you get some of those signs, but then take it easy and then sort of the sort of average, you know, level of wealth or attainment surpasses, you might then feel behind. So, but there's no end to this, right? There's no end to the status game.
No.
It's just ever more, it'll sucks up more of your time, more of what's important in life, just for that goal. And it's self-defeating in its own way as well, because, I mean, you might feel initially happy and pleased with yourself from a new status attainment, but psychologically, we normalize really quickly to those. And we totally. Basically, this is a well-established fact of psychology. You know, we have this boost of kind of happiness when you have a new attainment, and then you quickly revert back to the previous level of happiness you had before the attainment.
Right.
So, I mean, they call this a hedonic treadmill because mm-hmm. it's like running on a treadmill, going for a little bit more pleasure when in fact you're not ever getting any happier over the longer run.
Right.
And for a lot of people, maybe they don't know anything else or whatever. So of course, yeah. And they find something interesting in the work and, you know, they get talented and there's intrinsic joy from that skillful activity. So that's sort of maybe something like their surfing. But for surfers, it's like, you know, what really makes you happy, you know,
right.
like surfing really good waves, you know, like the meaning of life is right there. Like that day, you like
even everything's bad there. Waves.
Yeah. Even bad waves. Right.
Just going. That's where I am now. It's like, or certainly with this winter in Southern California, it's like, I don't even need to catch waves. Just paddling out, getting in the cold water, getting a little bit of sun, that's almost enough.
Yeah, you know? Right.
I mean, getting waves is better.
Yeah, but. Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, that's another nice thing for me about writing the book is that in thinking more about the simple beauty and sublimity of waves and riding them, I could start cruising down the line on a small little wave and just really enjoy it intrinsically without feeling like,
you got to get barreled.
It's inadequate. I got to get, you know, I still do a certain amount of tube chasing, et cetera, but, you know, but it's not like, you know, my life as a surfer is incomplete if I haven't done that, you know, do that, you know, I mean,
right.
So less about the chase and more about something that's just about the life of the surfer. When you think about it, is like a process of ebb and flow, right? Like there's swell and then you surf and then you wait in between waves and you do other things. And, you know, there's the cycle of the ocean and the swell storms generating and it's just like that's beautiful in its own way, and surfers just intrinsically understand that because it's what we never really know.
It actually segues perfectly into another kind of constant theme in the book, and maybe even the most used word in the book is flow, you know, and trying to be in flow in regard to life, work. Surfers are kind of predisposed to it for the reasons that you just said. They're kind of trying to always be in that. I've personally found, and then that relates to attunement, which is something that you've been talking about too. I've personally found my best surfing experiences and just my happiest experience in life is when I'm in that moment, when you're actually in the moment. You know, you're not regretting something in the past. You're not anxious about something in the future. You're just kind of there in the moment. And specifically in surfing, it's about me trying to kind of not impose my will on the wave.
Right.
If I paddle out, if I get a wave and I'm trying to think of the way I surfed the last wave and improve upon that, I've already lost the plot. You know, I just kind of got to get up, let muscle memory take over. And that's when I kind of have my best performances. So how do you define flow?
Yeah.
Let's start there.
Yeah. So I thought, well, look, I mean, flow is actually a studied topic in psychology, that, you know, the flow state. There's a lot of work on that, cognitive science and psychology work. But I thought, wait a minute, like, if anyone knows about flow, it's surfers. Like, it's not just a metaphor. Like, surfers literally get carried along with a changing natural phenomenon. They're carried along by the natural propulsive forces, precisely by being in the flow of that. It's also a flow, right? So mm-hmm. being in the flow of a flow. And then, so what is that? I think the essence of it is, be adaptively attuned to the wave, to each moment of the wave as it changes, right? And where you do that for its own sake. And so that's sort of the minimal basic idea of flow. But you can sort of, if you're a good enough surfer, you can go out and do that even if you're not in the peak state of performance, sure. right? Or you're not in the zone, you know, the flow state in that sense. But you're already in the way you just described really nicely in this relationship of adaptive attunement that draws you into the present, that involves not forcing things, not imposing your will. I mean, you don't know well enough what a wave's going to do. You can't impose your will on it. You have to watch and wait and see what it's going to do and just react moment by moment. And then this beautiful thing happens when you've done the right thing in each moment. You know, the flowing pattern emerges. You linked all the sections together. The turns all connected. You never caught a rail. You know, like maybe there was a surprise, like tail slide or floater or whatever. You know, or a zing on a turn. You know, and then the whole thing just connects. And then those are some of the most stoked moments. Even if you're not surfing your absolute best, you just feel like, whoa. You know, there's this. The feeling of stoke there is, as I think of it, is a fortunate coalescence between skill and circumstances. Like, so circumstances and your skillful activity, neither of which on their own could make for this flowing, you know, pattern line through the wave. But then it happened. And then mm-hmm. at the end of the wave, you have this sense of sort of delight and fortune because you're like, wow, everything came together. I was there for that. Like, this is a good enough reason to be alive right here. You know, so that's the sort of basic idea thing that surfers really know about flow, and it's already a source of joy and happiness. But then if you turn to the psychology literature, this really surprised me when I look back at it. This guy who wrote the sort of most famous book about this called Flow, his name is, it's a word that starts with C that C is unpronounceable, but you say it, Csikszentmihalyi. He wrote a book, but he characterized flow or the flow state as a state of optimal experience, as he calls it. So now, if you're a philosopher, you look at that and you're like, optimal experience. So it's just an experiential state. And he thinks it's just a state of mind. It's not a relation to your environment. It's just a state of mind. And it gets induced, he thinks, by controlling your mind, by self-discipline. And it turns out this is really just Stoic thought from late antiquity. It's really similar to their idea. They thought if you sort of organize, if you regulate your thoughts and adapt them to your circumstances, then you can induce happiness, tranquility, regardless of what happens to you. So it's not exactly about adapting your circumstances and getting to a flowing relation with your environment. It's more just managing your own mind so that you keep a state of equanimity, whatever happens. So if you could be in a concentration camp, for example, and then you can still have a state of tranquility because you're just accepting your circumstances, adapting your desires to your circumstances like that. And in fact, Csikszentmihalyi, he was influenced by this book by Viktor Frankl called Man's Search for Meaning. And that was inspired by concentration camp survivors from Nazi Germany. And he basically revived Stoic thought because they use Stoic techniques sort of adaptation, just basically to cope with awful circumstances, right? Mm-hmm. So it does work for that purpose, but it's not the same thing as what the surfer knows, you know, which is about being attuned to your environment, right? And it's about being efficacious. It's not just, so in other words, you can't just be in the surfer's flow if you're on an experience machine, a virtual experience machine doing virtual surfing. There, I mean, it might be like playing a video game, surfing video game, but you're not really surfing in the sense of you're not really being adaptively attuned, and you're not efficacious in the sense of actually successfully going down the line, you know, finding the harmonious adaptation between skill and circumstance. I mean, that's not all happening. That's the fact that happens is what's so like wonderful and joyous about surfing, what we're like grateful for, or feel fortunate about, why we feel grateful to be alive. Like a surfing video game could be really fun, and like I would try it if it's convincing, but it's not just having an optimal state of experience isn't the same thing. So surfing really brings out, I think, why flow isn't just an experiential state. I mean, that could be part, it's certainly part of it and part of an enjoyment, but not the whole thing.
Yeah, and it would certainly be like the emotional component of it, but it wouldn't have the economical benefit that you lay out in the book and even the physical benefit. Yeah. You know, all sorts of other things. The WSL refers to speed, power, and flow as a part of their judging criteria. Right. They don't have style in the criteria,
right.
But I feel like speed, power, and flow is kind of how they word it.
Right.
And it's interesting to hear you talk and then think about, like, I've seen guys, certainly here in Southern California, you see guys waste a wave essentially on a high performance shortboard, take off, pump down the line, just looking for an air section, or maybe at worst do a chop hop or something And it's the opposite of flow.
That's not flow.
And it's like, well, that was ugly. Why was it ugly? Yeah. You know, I'm not sure why it was ugly. And as you think about it, it's the antithesis of flow.
Even in the surfing judging criteria, they're not, flow isn't just an experiential state. It's a property of the relation between the surfer and the opportunities that were afforded by the wave and the sense to which they were attuned, you know, such spontaneous kind of speed and power are emerging from, you know, the relationship.
It's kind of a transference of energy, I think.
At
the right moments when it's offering it.
I mean, you know it when you see it, right?
Yeah, you do. Well, that was going to be my question to you, actually, is as a surfer, who do you think best represents the state of being attuned?
Yeah, I guess, well, famously, Tom Curran, of course, he was known, you know, for his attunement. But, you know, nowadays, you have to mention Slater, and maybe Parco, I guess, partly style influences it to some degree, you know, his great style. But I think that helps him really be a flowing surfer as well. You know, a really attuned surfer.
The reason why I ask is I agree. Tom Curran is kind of the best example. Yeah. And you've heard countless stories of people who have been on surf trips with him where they're just like, oh, we were surfing, you know, this part of the reef or this part of the point. That's where the waves were coming all day. Then Curran paddled out 100 yards past us where there was nothing. And then all of a sudden, the best wave of the day popped up and he got barreled all the way down the point.
Right,
you know?
Right.
There's a lot in this book that implies that being attuned leads to happiness and satisfaction. So my question then to you is, do you think Curran is happier than you and I are?
I mean, I think being attuned is, I mean, it's, so I'm here, there's an ancient idea that's in Plato and Aristotle that you're doing, happiness is doing well. And so just in being more attuned, you're doing well as a surfer, right? So that is a kind of happiness. It's of what the ancients called eudaimonia. But I don't know. So you can have, but you could have a surfer who really does well as a surfer and they're doing well in that regard. They're happy as a surfer in that regard, but otherwise maybe they have a discontented emotional life or, you know, a lot of family friend problems or something like that, or
but maybe if
suicidal. So potentially, but other things being equal, other things being equal, doing well, surfing, being attuned, not just on the particular wave, but being attuned, you know, to your environment and the way surfers are, you know, often, I think that itself does significantly contribute to the quality of a person's life.
So Curran's happier than we are.
Well, other things being equal, if he also had the other things, the other good things in life, and he might, that we might have, you know, good relationships. I don't know what it's like. Really, you know?
But the conceit of the book is that they're not equal though, right? That this thing is actually, this act of surfing is overarching.
Well, I guess, I mean, I definitely think a lot of things contribute to the quality of a person's life. But the idea is that adaptive attunement in surfing and also in other areas, like, is a really big component. You know, it contributes a lot to it, right? And so someone could have a lot of that, but then be lacking in other goods and still, you know, not be as happy. But it's a lot easier to just be a happy person if you're a surfer and like really dedicated to it. And that's reflected in the fact that people think of surfers as like easygoing or light about being.
Sure.
And there's a sense in which, they're like, what's there to, you know, problems are a little lighter, you know, well, as long as you've been surfing recently or you got vivid memories are vivid, you know.
I just want to know for a fact, if I commit this next phase of my life to surfing and attunement, that I will reap the benefits of it and happiness.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I feel sure of it. Yeah.
Have you read, Sean Thompson wrote a book a few years ago. He called it The Code. It was kind of for kids, or not for kids, for like preteens or teenage.
I think I saw some parts of it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He basically gave you like 12 rules to live by, that discusses some of these things, but he talks about Kelly's attunement and, specifically being Sean, being in the commentator's booth at J Bay 2005. It was Kelly and Andy Irons in the final. Andy had Kelly's back against the wall. Kelly needed like a 9-something. And the clock was winding down. There was literally a minute left on the clock and a set pops up on the horizon. Sean and everybody in the booth's like, oh, we don't know if this set's going to get here in time. And, you know, especially there, the size of the waves, you can't see past that first line. And Kelly paddles over it. And everybody's tripping. They're just like, why didn't he go? Why didn't he go? Second wave paddles over the second wave. And now it's down to like 15 seconds on the clock. And they're not sure if the third wave is going to be better or if there's even going to be time for it to get there. He gets it with like 15 seconds left on the clock, the third wave of the set, surfs out of his skin and gets the 9.6 or whatever it was that he needed, like after the buzzer, ends up winning. And Sean was blown away. Sean being a local there and like understanding it and having a lot, he was blown away that he wouldn't have waited for the third wave of the set, you know? And, but he said it was the best example he's ever seen of somebody being attuned with the ocean.
Did he use the word attunement?
Yeah. I don't remember if
he used the word. It was the idea. Yeah.
But it I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Right. No, he's one of the more articulate surfers I can think of. Sean Thompson is, pretty impressive. I actually went to this event at UCLA and it was surfers at UCLA talking, I guess it was about surfing, but Sean Thompson was there. And then I took a friend of mine who's a retired philosophy professor and law professor, and his name's Marshall Cohen. And he's somebody who's, you know, he's been like an influential, you know, and known person for a long time. And he's known or good friends with a lot of the great philosophers of the 20th century. So he's really a kind of a consummate intellectual and, and really into the arts. And I introduced him to Sean Thompson at this event thing and both at the event and then talking to him, and Marshall was like so impressed with him. He was like, just how with his articulateness and, what he said. Yeah.
Sean mentioned, I don't know if he wrote this in the book, but he mentioned it to me when he was telling me that story. Was he talked to Kelly after the fact. He was just like, what were you thinking? And Kelly said that he saw a pod of dolphins who showed him the way. And I don't know what Kelly was implying by that, but Sean was dead serious. And Sean was confused too, though. He wasn't sure how serious Kelly or what Kelly meant to imply by that. But he said quite literally, like, there was a pod of dolphins and I kind of got a sense or a feeling that they were trying to show me something or tell me something. And I don't know if he literally followed them or if he just used that as a sign. It somehow communicated. And that's kind of the point that I was going to make, was like somehow nature communicated with him, whether it was dolphins or just what is attunement. You know, it could just be reading the horizon line or something.
There is a real intuition that you can't explain. It can be a real kind of perception. I mean, like a famous example of this in the psychology literature is the fire chief who, is in a building, just suddenly has a sense that the building's going to blow, and then tells everybody to get out. And then the thing blows. Right. And then they ask, well, how did you know? And he's like, I don't know. Right. But no, it's not just, he wasn't born with this, right? It's from an accumulative sort of sense of what's going on. And some scientists have tried to look at like connections between water heaters and certain smells or whatever. And so you could gradually, you know, by being with enough experience and skillful engagement, you know, your attunement can get pretty heightened such that circumstantial cues can just put you in a certain way of thinking that, you know, with expectations, and they can be pretty reliable, even if you can't fully conceptualize and put words on it, whatever. And so it could have been that like Slater, he did saw something, right? He saw a bump or a splash or whatever that just, maybe if you really articulated it, you know, couldn't quite be explained, you know, if it was just the one or two waves coming. But it's not like he really thought through that, right, or reasoned that out. It was just like a spontaneous sense. He's learned how to trust like his really refined sense of these things. He goes with it, and then there it is. Famously, when people make these judgments, sometimes they'll tell stories about like, oh, here's what I was thinking. And then psychologists also study and show that like a lot of times people's explanation after the fact can't be right. So they'll say, oh, they just confabulate, they just make things up, or whatever. But I don't. That doesn't show that they didn't really know that they, or there wasn't even really a kind of reasoning going on. It's just a very spontaneous attune kind of thing that's not highly conceptualized. Something that you have words for that you can really think through, and that's just what heightened attunement involves. It's still a kind of knowledge. It's still a kind of perception. It's still something maybe in principle one could unpack and reason about. And I think all surfers have that to some degree, just your expectations about which way a wave is going to pop or when it'll double up or, you know, so.
Yeah, you have it more than somebody who's never been in
the ocean. Yeah, right. So it's all different degrees of attunement. And then, you know, you can get to higher heightened states. A big part of this, maybe this is part of, for, you know, middle-aged surfers that want to, like me, who want to double down on surfing as their midlife strategy or whatever. Something that elite athletes do, like Slater, but in other sports as well, is that this is separating the top of the pros versus the next layer down, is that the next level of pros, is that they're constantly disrupting their own expectations about what's going to happen and sort of creating new problems so that they can then look again and find a solution. And so that's how they get even more and more attuned to a wide variety of circumstances. So you avoid stagnation, you know, in that way, and get even more and more perceptive in a completely spontaneous way. And so that's not something like in the moment that you can articulate, but you can pretty self-consciously, keep upsetting your expectations about things, looking fresh at things. You can sort of do that, you know, by really paying concerted attention, doing new things, trying new things.
Have to, if you're at a level where there's no opponents to really challenge you.
Yeah, right. So just continue to challenge yourself. I mean, that, and you know, you can do that with trying different surfboards or different types of waves. Yeah. And that's something, one reason I think people like that, trying new kinds of surf spots, and then, you know, developing in lots of ways that maybe don't even fit the conventional scripts about surfing performance, you know? If you're past your prime and you're not worried about, succeeding by the conventional standards or whatever, then, you know, who cares? You know, you can, there's a lot of ways to become ever more attuned to the waves and to a new approach or a new styling or, so I think you can still do the things that, you know, someone like Slater's doing to get ever more attuned. Yeah.
I mentioned that he was surfing in that final against Andy Irons. Tell me the story about the time he burned you at Lowers.
Oh yeah. This happens a lot. I mean, I've surfed there really a lot, like over 30 years, but especially over the last 20, like a lot, like aside from traveling, like every swell. So I know pretty well. There's just like the trick to surfing there is just being on the money spot, right? You know, like a lot of breaks, but there it's like,
there's one peak.
Yeah. And then he, I guess there was a wave he thought was his or whatever. And then I was on the money spot and so he just dropped in on me, and then I think I hooted him off or something like that, you know, like, got it. And then he was sort of irritated by that. So as I pedaled, I'm like, what's this, you know, hooting, yelling? I'm like, look, I mean, like I was in position. I just said the basic things, you know, there's not really a line. I was in the position, you know. And then he was like really frustrated, like, so much for the Aloha spirit or whatever. And I was like, this is Lowers, you know?
So did he kick out when you hooted him?
Yeah, he did kick out. But okay. There was another wave where he dropped on me again. But I think, you know, he kind of dropped in and surfed a little bit and then kind of kicked out. But it was a little... And then, I think he said there, he's like, you're on every wave or whatever. But I felt like... You're Andy Irons. You're like a great surfer. Like you don't, and a great competitive surfer, great crowd surfer. It's like, you don't need my help. You know, like, what do you
I, I think once you've got a world title or two under your belt, you kind of just drop in with impunity and assume that whoever's behind you would just as soon watch you surf.
Yeah,
as they would hoot you off a wave. He's probably not used to getting hooted off.
No, it's true. A lot of the best surfers, I mean, just people are more deferential. Like, oh, they're paddling for it. They must got it. They must have got it. They must be in the right position. Okay, so, you know, you just don't contest. And then I think they just get used to that. And, you know, that's probably what it was, yeah.
I went to, like, a surfer pole award show, like, 10 or 15 years ago or something. And there was this long line at the bathroom. And I had waited in the thing forever. And I got right to the front. And then he walks up and tried to just push me out of the way to go right into the front of the line without waiting.
Oh, man.
And I blocked him.
Yeah.
I actually don't even know. I don't think I fully recognized who it was at first. Mm. I was just like, who's this guy? So I kind of blocked him. And then he made fun of me. I realized who he was, and he started making fun of the shirt I was wearing, and then everybody was laughing at me, and it hurt my feelings.
Oh, yeah. That was the funny thing. So when he was kind of yelling at me, and then I was like yelling back. But then the other people around were like, you know, they were kind of like looking down and
hiding.
Even like people I know and talk to all the time, they're kind of looking away because like, I don't want to get on the wrong side of Andy.
Exactly.
Like, I know you, bro, but like, don't bring me into this kind of thing. Like,
Well, what are your concerns for global warming as a surfer? Getting back to the serious stuff in the book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think so. I mean, surfers, you know, aside from the fact that, you know, human concern for, you know, vast numbers of people who, you know, be killed or displaced or, you know, even if you're, you know, you don't care that much about people, surfers, definitely, well, we care about waves, you know, we care, and not just any waves, we care about, you know, the waves that we know and love, right? Not just our home breaks, but places that we've been or places we'd still like to go. And I think it doesn't take much by way of a certain kind of conservative moral outlook, like to be concerned to conserve the valuable thing we've got. So we've got this valuable resources, you know, these reefs, these breaks, you know, like many, you know, acquired, you know, thousands and thousands of years of geology and ocean flows to create these things. And then to have them just submerged, you know, and become like high tide mushy crap, you know, because of sea level rising, if it's avoidable, you know, is just seems like sort of wrong, right? And now, like, there's a debate you can have, which I've had with some friends who say, well, you know, there's an upside, which is that like a lot of spots that are now too low, like too shallow for surfing, that are only breaking on high tides, those spots will come back, right? You know, there's a spot actually on Nias, right at the bottom of Lagundri Bay, called the Machine, that when the earthquake brought the reef up by like 3 meters, that spot became too shallow for surfing. So that the machine will come back, maybe, you know.
Right. I kind of agree at this part of the book. I kind of agreed with your friend and his argument, is not only might those spots come back, but there could be brand new spots that you've never even seen before, haven't even heard of, you know.
Right.
Like, I don't feel I feel pessimistic about climate change for other reasons. Selfishly, as a surfer, I feel like there's untold potential. You know, there's potential for magic.
Even like, you know, in Namibia, you know, Skeleton Bay is a relatively recent formation on a sandbar. So maybe there's stuff that like that could happen that wouldn't have happened otherwise. My friend is Graham Bird, and from Durban, South Africa. So I've had this argument with him, but he, with his like South African friends, they're with me. Like, no, this is just a disaster. And so my thought is, well, look, there might be some upside, but it's not just a cost benefit analysis where you're looking at like an upside, and then there's the loss, you know, of all these great ways, but then there's the upside, and then we just balance the cost versus the benefits, and we ask whether there's a net, you know, and then we just adapt from there. The more conservative idea is that, well, no, the loss, the thing we're losing is it's almost like a sacred thing. It's not just a cost. It's really awful. It's sort of, it's really terrible for us to have this valuable thing, and to just let it be degraded massively, when we can avoid it. So, you know, I mean, to some extent, like that's, you know, to some extent, the processes are outside of our control, you know, whether the technologies will emerge. At this point, it's not clear that the politics are ever going to do enough about global warming and changing our standards. I mean, I still think we should, but at the moment, the bet is on technology, that green energy is going to, you know, breakthroughs are going to be enough to both give us new energy, clean energy sources, and also suck down the carbon that's already up there, creating the greenhouse gas effect. You have to get all that stuff back into the ground somehow, right? And so algae does that to some degree, but you have to have new kinds of sinks like algae, you know, that do it on a huge, huge scale. So you need all that technology, and that stuff's under works. It works on a small scale, but whether it can be scaled up quickly enough to deal with the scale of the problem is a really uncertain kind of thing. At the moment, we're putting a bet on technology for that. You know, let's hope and pray that works. But I mean, my thought is, if you're a conservative in the conservation sense, you think, well, we shouldn't just put a bet on technology, just roll the dice. No. Like on that, you know, look, we should do a lot more to mitigate the impacts and reduce the disruption and the degradation of the environment that result. And then, you know, and then what kinds of things do we have to do? if they're a huge sacrifice, then maybe that's a problem. But what if it's just like shorten the work week so that we don't emit as much and and do relatively less consumptive activities like go surfing or you know, doing more walking for people who aren't surf or more gardening or something like that. And then the idea is, well, look, maybe we're not only not worse off in a world where we're adapting, if we're as well off as we are now, or even better off, then there's no sacrifice at all. And in that sense, climate adaptation can be efficient in the economist sense of there's some people who are better off, future people who are now not, you know, displaced. But then the current generation, we can be no worse off than we were before for various kinds of adaptations. And if that's the case, then it's not like there's this big sacrifice that you have to justify from a moral point of view. It's like we have sort of no excuse, like right. Twist my arm, like work less and go surfing more often. That's my contribution to the legitimacy of capitalism. And, so then what? How can we reasonably complain of being asked to do that? I mean, some people will complain, but is it reasonable? You know, is a further question.
Right. And that's assuming that your surf experience contributes less carbon emission than your work experience.
Obviously. Yeah, right. So the act of surfing itself is carbon free, you know, but there's, you know, the process of getting to the beach or like certain amount of travel or whatever, you'd have to worry about that. I mean, you're not contributing anything on the climate change front if you work less and then emit as much or more.
Or if your work doesn't emit carbon.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's right too. Yeah. So, I mean, at the level of the individual, you know, like anything that we do personally makes only a tiny difference on this front. But so the way to think about the big question is what we do in terms of overall societal norms and averages.
Yeah.
Right, so we already got the 40-hour work week at, you know, the 1930s, and that was that was the beginning of the leisure revolution within capitalism, as I put it. But now what I'm saying is, well, what we should just do is just continue the leisure revolution by keep pushing back the work week less and less, and then find new ways of using our leisure time with less consumptive activities. And that is a good way, perfectly good way of adapting on a changing planet that can leave us no worse off and better off, and then future people definitely better off. So that's an efficient adaptation, and so I think then morally necessary.
Yeah. How has your book been received by the philosophy community?
Yeah, pretty good.
It's kind of a new discussion, right?
Yeah, it's an unusual experiment in public philosophy from their point of view. So I think they're interested in, and so the Assholes book was as well.
Sure.
And with both books, I'm kind of responding to, initially I felt like philosophers weren't doing a really good job of explaining ideas in a way that was really available to the wide audience, you know, sort of too concerned with their own sort of specialized arguments. And so in a way that the real importance of philosophy, you know, this thing that's a really important part of human culture, that, you know, people connected with universities are sort of entrusted with. You know, we have ways of making it a professional enterprise, almost scientific in the way we go about it. And that's all really important. But I think that we've sort of overdone that side of things and lost sight of what it is to really communicate with the broader public, the ideas that are really belong to everybody, right? That sort of we're entrusted in them, but not delivering on the side. So, and like, who knows exactly how to do that? But when I wrote the Assholes book, I thought, well, this is a way of trying to do that, like of a different experiment. I thought the experiments were that were out there in pop philosophy weren't as successful because they were still too tied to sort of like a philosophy lecture with a pop culture hook or something like that. Mm-hmm. So for people that wanted a back to school experience, they might read something like that, but there's a limited sort of broad public audience for people that want that. So I thought that philosophy should go a lot farther to really start from the sort of ordinary concerns that people have, you know, without presupposing an interest in philosophy. You know, so with the Assholes book, it was, you know, we're all stuck with an asshole in our lives. And we all feel frustrated at one point or another with having to deal with them. And then the idea of philosophy can help us define what the asshole is and understand the problem and maybe see our way through it. Then that's sort of speaking to something that an existential kind of problem that we all have. And then you see the value of philosophy and you can get into it from that way. And then if you do that, it turned out that not only resonated with people, but it also there's like interesting philosophical issues because there's sort of novel claims you can make or old things that are out there that have to be tweaked a little bit to really apply, and then they're fresh, you know. So that worked, and then sort of the surfing book was a similar kind of thing. Not as easy to make the connection, but
not as broad of an audience.
It's not as broad of an audience, but still the idea of like, okay, explaining this more familiar activity and trying to capture the meaning of it, making it that about the meaning of life, you know, and written in a way that isn't just for surfers, but for anybody who maybe just has a passing acquaintance with it, or who maybe read Barbarian Days and like the idea, yeah, but didn't maybe totally get the, like, what was so important about the surfing act itself, or, you know, something like that.
I remember Finnegan talking about almost secretly being a surfer, living in New York in the literary world, just being embarrassed about his surfing activity, and that book kind of being like a coming out of the closet, so to speak. And then it was very well received, though. It wasn't, yeah, nobody really, you know, gave him a hard time about it, obviously.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I was worrying about, is like, are philosophers taking the book seriously?
Oh, I think they see it for what it is, which is an exercise in pop philosophy. And then they're interested in seeing whether I can pull it off, or, you know, how you mix the different kinds of issues, you know.
Are they going to take up surfing?
I don't know if they're going to well, but there's some ways that it might sort of invite certain kinds of approaches. I mean, I will make, like, write professional articles that develop, like, topics from downstream from the book. So there's serious issues that you can extract from it that you would then develop in the more professional way for, like, a journal article or, sure, or an academic book. So it's pregnant with that stuff, you know, yeah, and some people might take it up in that way or just generate ideas in that way. I mean, it's done that for me.
Good.
Anyway. So, but for the most part, yeah, no, I think people like it. I mean, and you know, there are also just novel arguments there. Like the argument about climate change, is, and the reduction of the work week is a novel argument. So that's sort of just news from political philosophy point of view,
yeah,
even if it's not argued in the way that you normally would to meet up to academic standards. So I think they mostly just see it for what it is, as public philosophy, and are interested in, like, how one should do that, how we should do that, and whether, you know, this is a good model or not. Yeah. You know, yeah.
What is your current work life/surf life like? How do you manage it? Are you working less, surfing more?
Yeah, I do. I do have made a conscious effort to do it. I mean, in academia, you know, we'll tend to write too much, too many articles, agree to write, you know, too many articles or publish too many books. So I've scaled back to my ambitions on how productive I'm going to be, and then focus on sort of bigger, more interesting projects in that way. So I am pushing back, and also encouraged colleagues, you know, to do that as well. I did that when I was chair of the philosophy department, you know, kind of more of a quantity instead of quality instead of quantity kind of idea of production. So that's the kind of mini version of it, you know.
How many hours do you think you're actually working, and how many days a week do you surf?
Oh, I don't know. Oh, surfing. Yeah, well, it depends on the swell. If the waves are good, then every day, you know, of the swell. But, you know, normally like a few times a week, and then every day if it's more. But how much do I work is a really hard question, because, you know, it's
with 40 being the over under
40, yeah.
are you less than or more?
I don't know, because I mean I'm, the way my life is sort of pretty integrated, my life and work doing philosophy, so it's sort of like passing thoughts could be an aha moment, or so that's when a lot of the real action happens, you know, kind of out and about.
That's another issue I had, yeah, trying to make the book fit my personal, yeah, life, is I don't know when I've worked a 40-hour work week. I don't know that I ever have.
Right.
And I think that the trend is kind of moving away from it, certainly with, you know, tech companies like Google and stuff like, yeah, that. Like, you don't have to put in 40 hours in front of a computer in the office. Right. And we incentivize you to sleep 8 hours, right, a day and all that sort of stuff. I think that I am, yeah, so much of my work is happening while I'm driving to this meeting, for example.
Right,
I'm generating ideas and, yeah, solutions and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so I think it's hard to define. I mean, for people that are sort of have already sort of carved out a more kind of flexible or creative kind of life, then it's harder to, but are, but the workplace really has a sort of structure that's enforced on people on condition of keeping their job.
Sure, of course.
And to some extent, the work, the new flexibility that you get just eats up more of people's leisure time. So like now,
yeah,
like,
it does.
So a lot of times you're like, okay, you don't have to be here, but now, but we're going to hit you with emails and ask you to do things like all the time, all hours. So like in some sense, leisure isn't protected in the way that it was once, at least on average, or there's larger trends. I mean, Germany, for example, the lazy Germans, as I like to call them, they have a 36-hour work week, they have 6 weeks vacations, and they rigidly segregate work and leisure. So there's leisure time is protected. That's your time. And it's really a no-no to like email and ask for things off that time. I mean, the whole idea of German efficiency, right, is that, no, it's like we're reducing the work week because you can produce just as much within the smaller amount of time. Right. And then, you know, do it in a focused way instead of like being at, you know, long hours at work and wasting a lot of it, like cruising the internet, you know, just vegging, so that's like a pretty surfer attitude about it, I think, you know.
Yeah. Adding that level of structure to it isn't.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. But it's a way of the structure in that, and this, what we need now is more structure to give people permission to take the time off. Or even like Americans officially get 2 weeks vacation in a lot of workplaces, or that's kind of a norm, but people don't take it. They take a week.
Yeah.
They only take a week because there's the pressures of not looking like your contributor or not looking, you know, and that's the culture of like, well, look, we've got a lot of work to do. And like what you just want to go to, you know, Spain? I mean, come on, you know, like you want to go vacation. Oh, sure. Right. That's fine on your time. You know, so, so I think that's a problem with the larger, culture. And so it really is an important thing to have the institutions, structured so that you can push back against those pressures.
Yeah.
And that's for a lot of people, you know, who haven't sort of devoted their life to carving out a surfer's path through all the conventional expectations. You know, they need that to be protected against the social pressures that are eating up, you know, their leisure lives.
Sure. I wanted to get you to weigh in as a philosopher on a couple of surfing kind of existential quandaries that we have going on right now, if you wouldn't mind, outside of the book.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on wave pools?
Yeah, right. Okay.
I'm sure you've thought about this.
I have been.
Have you surfed any?
No, I haven't. I haven't. I mean, I wouldn't mind, but I'm skeptical about their... I mean, well, one is the technology, you know, is obviously really interesting and a cool breakthrough. It's, you know, for professionalism, I don't know, it's a mixed thing. It obviously offers a lot of benefits to the WSL to be able to have a controlled... sort of playing fields and have competitions with quality waves and everything
in a 2-day window.
Yeah, so within on schedule, right? Yeah. The waves are there when they want to turn it on, and that helps with the Olympic bids and things like that. And but you know, and maybe I'd feel differently if I actually surf the Slater wave or whatever, you know. But at the moment, I'm pretty skeptical about it. I mean it's incredible long tube ride or whatever, but there really is something a lot lost, I think, in the environment. I mean, for one thing, to set aside the competitive context, the sense of the sublime, which surfers are really deeply acquainted with. I mean, this is you have the sense that this wave's coming from out from the ocean, and from maybe, you know, it's coming from the South Pacific or from, you know, a storm deep below, and you have this sense of connection just in waiting for the wave or seeing this wave with larger things, and larger natural processes, and that's a really big part of the beauty and in surfing, which is skillfully adapting to this thing that's beyond your control, that's naturally produced, and you know, the unpredictability of the waves, right, is all about. Is exactly why attunement is really important, and why you get to have the stoke in having everything come together, right? Because it's not just that your skill for performance came together; it's that the elements coalesced as well, right? And that could have easily not happened. And so this sense of stoke that it did, right? It just did. Whoa! This is, you know, life is the great. It's worth being alive rather than not just to be here for this, you know, kind of thing. So you get less of that just already in surfing the wave pool because you know, because it's a manufactured environment. There's still physical forces, obviously, creating the wave shape. But and there's some unpredictability, a little bit. There's a lot less unpredictability in the wave environment. So it's the kind of issue is whether you can, you know, learn the sort of, as it were, gymnastics set, you know, well enough so that you can bring your skill for performance up to the what it's offering, the possibilities that it's offering. And so that already takes out a really big part, like it reduces significantly a really big part of what's sort of deep and beautiful about surfing. Now, you might think, okay, that's fine if you're a purist, but for the point of view of competitive surfing, you know, this is, you know, just a supplement and it's just supplementing competitive surfing and, you know, and there's all kinds of commercial advantages, you know, associated with it. So I was open to that idea, like, okay, but, you know, I can see why if you need a world tour, you know, and you're trying to, you know, make it, you know, as popular as other sports or whatever, assuming that's a good thing. But I felt watching the contest, actually, so I was kind of watching it open, and I really felt that even the competition wasn't as good, it wasn't as interesting. It was more like gymnastics, is how I felt. I mean, it was more like gymnastics because it was sort of like, can this surfer, you know, do their personal best or beat their, you know, beat their previous thing? Can they get such and such score where, like, for the most part, the wave, I mean, it's obviously a really demanding wave, right? That was a kind of surprising thing to see, like, you know, these great surfers just, like, getting caught behind or whatever, you know, like, or mistiming, like, sections, you might think. So it's obviously a really demanding wave and requires a lot of skill, and there's some unpredictable elements. But it still was much more like gymnastics, in the, you know, where the challenge is just whether the competitors can sort of rise to the skill level that's needed in the moment, not whether the ocean is going to cooperate or whatever. And I think I think it clarified for me that the thing I love about watching the other surf contests, especially when the waves are good, like the pipe contest or the Tavarua contest or the Chopu contest. You know, it's that interaction with the spontaneous elements of this, it's the sea. It's just doing its own thing. And then, you know, when things really come together, you know, I mean, it's an incredibly exciting thing to happen. And that's just sort of lost, even on, you know, the great, you know, maneuver or whatever, like, you know, John struggled through the whole thing, but he had this great, great air at the end of the wave. It was like, you know, an incredible, you know, feat of skill. Right. And that was sort of exciting, but it had a certain amount of spontaneity. But I got the sense that, like, John's greatness as a surfer is really because he's so attuned to the spontaneous changing of that, and he was kind of thrown off by being on a fixed stage. You know, like, it's kind of like the thing that makes the surfing great isn't really, like, keyed into that, right? So in the end, I felt a little disappointed with it, even as a venue for competitive surfing. Even that, as for competitive surfing, wasn't quite what's great about competitive surfing otherwise. So, I mean, maybe you could think of it as like a way of introducing surfing to the rest of the world, you know, to kind of get their feet wet on the idea of it, some of the concepts. But I don't think it really captures, you know, and puts on display, like, what's even great about competitive surfing, you know, which, after all, it isn't just about, you know, who can turn in the most skillful performance. You know, it's really, it brings in a lot more of the spontaneity and intangibles and the sense of the sublime and the beautiful that are the things that are really valuable about surfing, even in the non-competitive context.
Yeah, I agree. I actually surfed Kelly's pool in November.
Yeah, what'd you think?
It's amazing. I mean, it's amazing to surf.
Okay, yeah.
That's it, though. Like, it's remarkable. I only got four waves, and I pretty much blew them. Like, there's too much pressure and going into it.
Yeah.
You need a bit more time to kind of suss it all out.
Yeah.
But all that said, I agree with what you're saying. I would love to surf it again. I would absolutely go back. But the novelty of even surfing it, I think, will wear off.
Right.
And the novelty of viewing it certainly already has.
Yeah, right.
And I felt the same way with you about the competition thing. I thought that might be a real reason to have it, you know, but the competition was a letdown. And I came to the same conclusion as you, which was, while they were trying to kind of commodify the barrel and, like, let's make this something that we can always have because this is what we seek in nature, I think that zaps all of the value out of the barrel. The only value it had was its scarcity and its unpredictability.
Right,
and
right.
Not knowing where and when you were going to find it and traveling all that way to get a 3-second version of it, you know?
Yeah, right.
That's the value.
Yeah, right.
So I'm afraid that like that particular model that they're using and technology has real limitations because of the predictability. The new pool in Waco, I think, adds a lot more excitement.
Okay.
Because it's spontaneous. It's more spontaneous. Yeah. But that might grow old too. With 2 years of kind of retrospect and hindsight, we might feel the same way about that we do about KS Waveco. But then somebody mentioned something to me about, you know, when they introduce Supercross, people having this dilemma also.
Okay.
When you take any given Sunday, the film you mentioned previously, it's all about being out in nature, enduro racing, stuff like that, and finding, if you find a jump, you can hit it, you know, and got to compromise with it.
Yeah.
Well, then people go and build jumps, and now it's strictly about the maneuver you can do on that jump.
Right.
You could see something like that happening with wave pools. And now Supercross in no way challenges enduro racing at all. Okay. They're just entirely
They're just different sports,
you know, and neither party is offended by the other. But I think for that to happen in surfing, you would need to be able to create a wave that's more spectacular than what's in nature. Because in Supercross, they have. They have man-made jumps that allow you to do double backflips.
Right.
Where in nature, that's hard to find. You know? So until we could do that in wave pools, I don't know that they'll be able to make that transition. I thought it was interesting that, I'm sure you saw that Seth Moniz clip in the wave pool in Waco where he does a backflip.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is pretty much the gnarliest backflip we've ever seen in surfing.
Right.
You know, I mean, we might have seen crazier aerials and other type of air rotations. But the fact that the craziest backflip or the biggest backflip ever was in a wave pool, I think, is important.
Right. You know? Yeah, right, right. I mean, that, yeah, it's, that's a great comparison, which I hadn't thought about. But it I guess it fits also with the gymnastics analogy. It was like, so motocross already gone the gymnastics route, like fixed, very well-defined stage. And then it just becomes about the exquisite performance. We're going through a set routine, you know, which in, but now look at gymnastics, what it's like. I mean, it's very rigorous. And if you don't really know what you're looking at, it like all looks really similar, you know, like, you know,
Which as does surfing.
Yeah. Well, I guess to the, to the untrained
like
eye.
My dad
does,
who doesn't surf has mentioned it to me. Like, I don't know if he could tell the difference between a top turn that, you know, Coco Ho does versus one that Kelly Slater does something, you know?
Right. So there are, it's already, especially on the wave pool, it's all, it looks kind of similar. I mean, I mean, maybe it becomes like a different, it could just become a different sport that's just more like gymnastics. And like, not that there's anything wrong with it, but but you feel like if somebody just said, well, I'm only going to do that sport, I'm not really going to surf ocean waves, you know, you might feel like, well, you know, it's better than working or whatever, or working a crappy job, but you know, like you're really missing out on something, you know.
I don't think that they would get the experience that your book talks about.
Yeah.
You know, that you actually have to work for and endure and like suffer some consequence and put things, you know, physically be able to
it's all too easy. A sense of respect for the ocean, and you know, for its grandeur and sublimity, and I mean, and that's that the stuff that really like makes you feel like I just want to spend my whole life doing it, like this is the end of the rope, this is the end of the rainbow, this is the fountain of youth, you know, like you just keep doing this and you organize life around it. I don't know, I mean, I haven't surfed the wave pool, but you get the sense that it's more like a gymnast, you know, who gets really interested in this particular technically difficult activity. Maybe they're really good at it and they do it for a while, but, you know, I don't know, if, you know, but it's not something they do hardcore for too long or whatever.
Yeah. Well, surfing in the ocean, your book certainly highlights like all the economic benefit of surfing more than working, but it really doesn't even unpack all the emotional benefit of it, you know, and certainly the physical benefit of it. I think it does for a portion. You might reference it that you don't need to go to the gym really if you're an active surfer. But I mean, so much of what I get out of it is the emotional benefit of you know, you feel better afterwards. Period.
Yeah, that's true. That's fair, actually. And that comes because sort of the default way that people will talk about it in terms of emotions or feelings, like, oh, surfing makes me feel so good, or it's really enjoyable. But that sort of makes it just seem not, it's just sort of one way to get pleasure or one way to get enjoyment, and it's not special. So I was So my focus was really, well, what is the enjoyment about? The enjoyment is about something. And it's enjoyable because of what it's like. So what is it really like? What's special? And is there something special about it? And then I say, yeah, there is. But that doesn't mean also that the psychic benefits of it aren't really considerable.
Right.
And then of course they go along with, you know, the better it is as a, as an activity, the more enjoyable it can be for those reasons, sort of justifiably.
Yeah.
And it's different from just like a drug that you take that gives you a high or whatever.
Right.
I mean, it's not like, oh, heroin, but it doesn't like totally screw up your life. It only screws up your life a little bit, you know, like it could be internally induced, but you know, if only you could get that same high, just put it in a pill, then you wouldn't need to surf anymore. Cause you'd get the same enjoyment.
Yeah.
You know, but in fact, no, a sense of peace and a sense, I mean, the really deep and beautiful thing I think about like a great day of surfing, even a great wave, is that you're sort of, what might be called sort of being reconciled to the human condition. That is that you're here and there's life, and sure, life's really screwed up in lots of ways, but here I'm now and I'm really glad. Right. And that sense of appreciation, I mean, a lot of people rarely feel that, right? A lot of anxieties, you know, underlying anxieties come because they can't really just accept themselves as they are. There's striving perfectionism. There's people with like deep insecurities, and they're, you know, they're always fighting to be recognized and can't ever. I mean, there's, you know, a whole slew of sort of psychological disorders that, in a broad sense, ways that people can't find peace or maybe go to drugs or whatever, because that's sort of as an escape, because they can't sort of just accept, you know, themselves and the world they're in and feel at home in it.
Right.
That's a really, that kind of peace is a really deep and important thing in life. And surfers just, you know, fall into it, you know, like pretty easily. Right. And so that's a really blessed sort of way to be, you know?
It is, yeah. Couple of wrap up questions in the interest of time. What surfer currently would you kind of stop everything to watch a clip of?
Well, I've been following Griffin Colapinto, you know, our local local talent. He's on fire. I've been, you know, sort of just proud to, you know, because he's from Lowers, proud to sort of be in the mix and watch his star take off. So definitely him.
Do you follow his younger brother on Instagram, Corey?
I've checked it out a little bit, yeah.
I think, yeah, it is Corey, actually. The longboarder is who I'm thinking of.
Oh, longboard.
Because there's three of them.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I haven't followed the others as much, actually. Yeah.
I'll send it to you. Yeah. His younger brother surfs Sano a lot.
Yeah, okay.
And he shortboards too, but he's unbelievable on a longboard. I think his Instagram handle is KookApinto.
Oh, okay.
But he's spectacular.
Yeah.
Like cross steps and like all these weird fades, and it's really beautiful to watch.
Yeah. Oh, right. Right. Cool.
Are there any surf writers who you look forward to reading?
Well, definitely Bill Finnegan. You know, I'm following him. You know, he actually convinced me that I might. Well, I was thinking of writing. I go to NIAS every year, and I have lots of stories, and I also do some charity projects there. So lots of stories from that. I thought of a way of writing a book that is a philosophical book. He convinced me that I could write a memoir. A good way of developing, going for what I want, would be to write a memoir, which is just like tell the stories and then I can weave in philosophical stuff. So he was helping me with how to do that a little bit. And he's also says he's might do some similar stuff. So I'm following his lead on that. So that's one person.
What does your current quiver look like? Whose boards are you riding?
Oh yeah, I've been riding the sci-fi.
Are you really?
Slater sci-fi, yeah, and I really love them. Yeah, they're really great, and I'm really grateful for Slater. I mean, I'm almost willing to forgive him for the anorexic board years. You know, when he got us all riding these anorexic surfboards and set us all back. You know, but now that he's made like widely available the Tomo, you know, design, you know, and they just, for me anyway, they work really beautifully, and I love that they're mass produced. Like I took it a little while ago, I went to Tahiti and broke one there. And so I just left it And then, you know, on the way back from the airport at LAX, I just drove to the surf shop and got another one. You know, so it's like, no wait, no hassle. So it's like, it's super to have such a great board, just mass produced, widely available. So yeah.
Cool. Any upcoming projects or, I suppose, the next book idea you just revealed?
Oh, yeah, that's a longer term thing. Okay. I'm also writing a book about money, the nature of money, with a law and finance ace named Bob Hockett, a Cornell law professor. It's about why money is basically a kind of promise, a kind of IOU, and why we can make it from nothing, make promises. And the way you can make promises from nothing, you can create money from nothing. And then we can do things like pay for a basic income, which I've mentioned, you know, was defending for other reasons. That's how you can pay for it, is by using monetary policy. And so it's the philosophy and law aspects of that, of in a way that bears on the economics. Because believe it or not, economists, orthodox economists, don't really pay attention to money. They don't think it has any sort of fundamental role. It's the veil for the real economy. So we're writing a book explaining that. It's an original sort of intellectual argument, but it's be written for a broad audience, so a pop reader could read it, you know. And then there's another book I'm working on with a classicist about loudmouth women, and redefining the term loudmouth so that it's a good thing or virtue for women to speak out contrary to social norms when they have an important contribution to a conversation. And so that'll bring in ancient examples of, and then, you know, there's a bigger argument about the value of an inclusive democratic republic, you know, where everybody speaks up and stuff like that. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You've certainly been around the world a lot for surfing. You mentioned Nias in the book. You mentioned J-Bay, Nicaragua, among others, I'm sure. What's your next trip? You have anything exciting?
My next trip, probably back to South Africa, and then Indo. My usual trip to Indo.
Do you do that during the summer?
Yeah. Usually during dry season, you know, which coincides with the academic calendar summer. So that's really convenient.
Good. Yeah. Final question for everybody interviewed, which I might already know the answer to, is just what was the last surfboard that you rode?
The Sci-Fi was the last
that's
one.
What I figured. Which size do you ride?
The 510, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, shorter than I would have ever in the past, but with more volume. Yeah.
That's what's funny. You were talking about Slater, his trend in the 90s towards those potato chip boards, which is what I kind of grew up riding.
Right.
And definitely didn't do me any favors. He's using a lot less foam nowadays, too. I mean, he trended towards more foam, and then it's back to less. There's more volume packed in, but it's certainly shorter and shorter boards over the years.
Right.
I feel like just in the last three or four, he's added volume back.
Yeah.
But, man, when he first got off Channel Islands, those initial tests that he was riding were tiny.
Yeah, right.
They were like 5'8" and not a lot of volume at all.
Yeah, no, I admire the his willingness to experiment and stuff. So now we've benefited with that, you know. I think so. I mean, it's good if he keeps experimenting as well, but you know.
Do you think he's officially or unofficially retired?
I'm guessing probably. Yeah, yeah, probably. I mean, it's just hard to, you know, hard to get excited, I think, by just the same old boring anymore.
Yeah, totally. Right on. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
What did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were a-blazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sound of a clown who cried in the alley. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard. It's a hard rains are gonna fall.
Thank you, Dr. James, for taking the time. Really enjoyed our conversation and also really enjoyed the book. Provided some new insights for me, and it was a good exercise and a re-examination of philosophy that I haven't really taken since college, so a while back. Anyways, everything that Aaron and I discussed is available. Links to his books, all that sort of stuff is available on surfsplendorpodcast.com. I've also got a video clip of him getting drained on a well overhead right-hander at Nias. So the guy can surf, and he actually went and surf lowers right after our meeting. So hopefully that made it worth his while to drive south. As I stated at the beginning of the show, if you support this show in the month of June, you'll be entered to win that Morningwood Surfboards Alaya. You have my preemptive thank you and the internal warmth of just knowing that you did something good. All right, so thanks for that. Follow everything on social media at Surf Splendor. Check out this week's episode of The Grit with Matt Warshaw and Chaz Smith, recounting our experience in Florida at the Florida Surf Film Festival and Chaz's new documentary film, Trouble, the Lisa Anderson story. It's actually not quite finished. We screened an unfinished version there in Florida, but it'll be available soon, and of course we'll tell you all about that. I believe that's all I have today in the way of business, so I will leave it there and remind you to get back into the ocean, to share a couple of waves, and as always, shred on.
I walk to the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and their hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison. And the executioner's face is always well hidden, where hunger is ugly, where the souls are forgotten, where black is the color, where none is the number. And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I'll know my song well before I start singing. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard, it's a hard rain are gonna fall.